Well, good evening, everyone. It's lovely to see so many of you and see so many visitors. You're very, very welcome. I hope you've all managed to get something to drink and to nibble on. If you haven't, don't worry, because we will be serving some more teas and coffees at the end. So if you're able to stay around, then please do. It would be great to chat to you a bit more. So this evening is another of our regular Hot Topic series, and I think some of you will have seen these little leaflets that we've put together. We have got some at the back, if you've not seen these, and they give the programme of Hot Topics up to the 15th of June. And so you can see the topics there and the speaker, a little biography of the speakers. They're the same time each month, 6:45 till about 8:15 p.m. And our website is on there as well. So we've got all the details on the website. And did you know that you can submit a question in advance? And even if you can't be here, you can submit a question and we'll make sure that gets answered. I don't think we've had any questions submitted so far on the website. So please do take advantage of that. Because you know what it's like, sometimes you're offered the chance to ask questions. I don't want to ask that. So you've got the opportunity to submit that online. So just as a quick plug, next month, which is the 13th of April, we have a guest speaker who's a tutor at the OCCA, which is the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. It is a lady called Sharon Dirks, and she's going to be talking on the subject of why, God, evil and suffering. Now, I don't know many of your backgrounds here, but in conversations that I've had with people over the years, that's the one question that I always, always, always get asked. If God exists, why is there suffering in the world? So I would really encourage you to come along to that. Sharon Dirks is a PhD in brain imaging from the University of Cambridge, no less. And she's held research positions both in the UK and in the USA. And she has also published her book called Why? God, Evil and Suffering. I don't think she's here to do a plug, but I'm sure she'll be bringing copies of her book if you'd like to pick that up. So she is local. She does live in Oxford. So that's the 13th of April. But again, please do take a leaflet or check our website if you've not made a note of the dates. In the Bible, the Apostle Paul, who you may have heard of, he wrote a letter to the Corinthians. And in the 15th chapter of 1 Corinthians, his first letter, he wrote this. If Jesus Christ has not been raised from the dead, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. More than that, we are then found to be false witnesses about God. He's talking about himself and his fellow apostles who went around talking about the gospel, the good news of Jesus. He says, we have testified about God that he raised Christ from the dead, but he did not raise him if in fact the dead are not raised. For if the dead are not raised, then Christ has not been raised either. And here's the real punchline. He says, if Christ has not been raised, your faith is futile. So the Apostle Paul says, listen, if Jesus didn't rise from the dead, we're all pretty much wasting our time. We may as well pack up and go home. And I have many conversations with people. I'm not a Christian worker. I work in an office. But over the years, I've had lots of conversations with people in different walks of life. And there's two things people really want, people that are not believers. They want proof. That's the first thing they want. They want proof that God exists. And there's two things they want. There's lots of things they want. But another thing they really want is to know why Jesus of Nazareth should be heeded above all the others. You know, there's lots and lots of different religions. If you were here towards the tail end of last year, we did a talk on what about all the other religions in the world? Why is Christianity unique? Why should we believe that that one's true and the others are false? So people want to know why Christ should be heeded above all others. The resurrection, if it's true, sets Christ apart from anybody else that came before him or came after him. I can say that without fear of contradiction, because nobody else as far as we know, has been recorded as rising from the dead. This is not a natural occurrence that we see. We, of course, hear tales of people sort of resuscitating on the operating table, but that's not quite the same thing as a man who was buried in a tomb for 3 days and came back to life. So the resurrection, if it's true, it sets Christ apart as extremely unique. So the question before us is it true? Is there evidence? And Steve Meston, many of you will know Steve, he's a member of our church and has researched the resurrection over many years. And Steve is this evening going to lay before us the evidence for the resurrection. I hope you'll find it challenging and enlightening, and you will have the opportunity to ask questions. So could I ask that during Steve's talk, if you could very kindly allow him just to get through the presentation, and then he will give you an opportunity to ask questions. And what he's going to do is just he'll do his presentation and then allow you just a couple of minutes to think through any questions that you'd like to ask. And then our friend Alistair will come round with a microphone just so we can all hear you and you'll be able to ask your question. And I would be grateful as well if you could keep your questions to the topic of the resurrection of Jesus. It's tempting to want to ask questions about all sorts of things, in which case let me give you a plug for the rest of our hot topics where you can ask those then. I've already done a plug for the next talk and the leaflet and the website, so all that remains is for me to welcome Steve Meston this evening. Thank you.
Thank you all very much for that welcome. Nice to be applauded when you're talking from a pulpit. Doesn't always happen. Actually, last time I did a talk, I won't say heckled, but there was a very vocal non-believer in the audience. But just to let you know that I got my fan club here tonight for anybody who's going to question me, particularly during the talk. So I'm sure they'll drown you out if you start objecting to anything I have to say. But if you do have objections, I'm quite happy to hear them, although the sooner you've left it to the end of the talk, so that's great. Jez was talking about the existence of God being very much down to the evidence for the resurrection. There certainly have been many arguments regarding the existence of God that have been put forward by theologians and philosophers, but as I say, one that stands out apart from the others is the evidence for the resurrection, in that it's not just an argument for God, in that a miracle occurred, which logically concludes the existence of God, but it also points the finger squarely at Christian theism. That is, that the God of the Bible raised Jesus of Nazareth from the dead in accordance with the prophetic writings of the Old Testament. During last month's lecture, John Blanchard, towards the end of his talk, made reference to something which, unbeknown to him, was a bit of a perfect segue into this evening's talk. He certainly had no idea what this evening's talk was about, but I don't know if many of you were here for John Blanchard last month. It was a particularly good talk, actually. He spoke about does science disprove God, which we came to the conclusion that it doesn't disprove God. He was talking about a conversation he'd had with somebody at a lecture he'd done a few years ago. And this person was, what should we say, was an avid atheist. And he kept interrupting him during his talk, which John didn't really appreciate too much. But he had the opportunity to talk to this guy at the end of the lecture, and they talked for quite a while, but John didn't really feel like he was getting anywhere. But he did, when the conversation came to the end, he said to him, "I want to ask you one question." And that question was, "What do you think of the person Jesus?" To which this person, who was, as I say, a passionate, militant, ardent atheist, a bit like Richard Dawkins, as many of you might have heard of, I'll come on to him later. He replied, "I'm not sure about the person Jesus, but I do know that everything hinges on whether or not he rose again from the dead." Which kind of sets the scene for this evening's talk. That technology works. Now, some of you may, of course, recognize this person. He is, of course, that fantastic science fiction writer responsible for the Out of the Silent Planet and Perelandra. Of course, I'm misleading you all here, because I think most of you probably recognize him. If I was just to say He wrote the Narnias of Chronicle, which was had books such as The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. What was his name? That's it. Well done, Pierre. Go to the top of the class. There, look, C.S. Lewis. That's his signature there. He did a series of radio talks in the 1950s, which were actually published into a book which was called Mere Christianity. And in one of his lectures, or one of his talks, he came up with the following quote, which really sets the scene for tonight's talk, and it went as follows. I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him, being Jesus, that is. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. Well, that is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and had said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about this being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. You see, the reason the man said it all depends on the resurrection was because he knew that the truth claims of Jesus were objective claims. And an objective claim is one that, whichever way you look at it, it can't be disagreed with. Like, for example, when I hold up my hand and say, there's five fingers there, there's five fingers. And none of you can say, well, that might be true for you, it's not true for me, that's not an option. So objective truth claim is what Jesus made. So either the tomb was empty on the third day after his crucifixion, or the corpse still lay there. There's no middle ground. Christianity is either true or it's false. So now we set the scene for tonight's talk. I wanted to look at three main areas, which are the reliability of the ancient manuscripts. We'll be taking a look at the ancient manuscripts themselves. And also be looking at some nuggets of evidence which we can extract by looking at the New Testament texts themselves. And finally, we will be looking at historical accounts from historians who, around about the time of Jesus and just after. Well, many people would say, I don't believe the stories of the Bible, so I don't believe in the man Jesus. It's something I certainly regularly hear myself. So what I wanted to therefore start with this evening is whether or not the truth claims themselves are the stuff of myth, or whether they're actually sincerely believed to have happened by the very people who witnessed the supposed events. Now, what you can see there, there's some fragments. The one on the right is a bit of, I think it's from Mark's Gospel. I'm not too sure what the other ones are, but I think the one in the middle might be from the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the one on the left is from Tacitus. He was a Roman historian. But these are just examples of ancient texts. We need to really examine the ancient texts if we're going to look at them rationally. We have to be prepared to appraise the testimony of the people who wrote them in the same way we would a witness's testimony in a court of law. I suppose when I say a witness's testimony in a court of law, we're sort of talking about a smoking gun scenario where, you know, you've got the smoking gun, you've got the fingerprints, you've got all the bits of evidence, but you don't actually have the physical proof, although it does point very strongly in a certain direction. That's what we're going to look at tonight, is the evidence for the resurrection. So if you're looking for proof, you're not going to get it. So I'm sorry to disappoint you if you've come here for me to prove to you that God exists, so you can walk away with your head held high, knowing that he does, because that's not what I'm here to do. But I am here to give you evidence. The only proof I certainly have is the one that's the proof that's in here, that I know that God lives in my heart. So, let's forget that they're contained in this volume called the Bible. When they were originally written down, they weren't neatly bound up with these individually with verses and numbers. They were certainly a scatter set of writings and letters, as we can see on the overhead projector. So when we study the ancient writings, such as Tacitus, Suetonius, or Socrates, or any of the New Testament, our starting point is the ancient writings themselves. Or at least it should be, otherwise it becomes just a game of Chinese whispers as the texts become distorted with each translation. I'm sure we've all played Chinese whispers and ended up with something completely different to what we started with. Well, let's have a look at that, shall we? This is Tacitus, the Annals of Rome, which was written in 109 AD, or there and thereabouts. Now, what you see there actually isn't an original, because I don't think Penguin Classics existed in 109 AD. In fact, we've got that book at home, I think. What you can see there is the earliest discovered copy of Tacitus' Annals of Rome. And as you can see, it's 850 AD, which is an incredibly long time after the book was actually written. So that's 741 years. And in fact, there are only two ancient copies in existence that have been so far discovered. I hope I'm right in what I'm saying, because I think there's the odd PhD student here tonight. Okay, so let's have a look at Mark's Gospel, which was assumed, or I think, yeah, historians say it was written in about 65 AD. There we have your Gideon's New Testament, which I think my kids have probably got one, haven't you? Did you get a Gideon's New Testament given to you at school? Well, the book of Mark's Gospel, the earliest fragments they have found from Mark's Gospel actually date from 250 AD, which is approximately 200 years after it was written. I think it may have recently been some fragments that are slightly earlier, but with only a few words have been found. But that's what they're looking at the moment. It's 250 AD, which is 200 years after it was written. But the funny thing is, whilst we only have two copies of Tacitus' Annals of Rome, 800 years after the event, we have about 11,000 copies of Mark's Gospel, ancient copies of Mark's Gospel, have been found to date. So that seems very strong. So why are we so often predisposed to accept the writings of Tacitus as historical certainties, but not the New Testament? Well, a possible argument could go like this. Couldn't the gospel accounts be just distortions in the same way as Chinese whispers might change a perfectly normal event into something it never was? A little bit like, I suppose, Robin Hood, for example. I mean, we often hear historians talking about this guy that probably existed, but myth has surely distorted the truth beyond all recognition. In much the same way, couldn't this have happened with Mark's gospel, which was written over 30 years after the event? I mean, can we all remember what we were doing 30 years ago? It wasn't actually that long ago, was it? So let's consider the evidence. Well, I certainly want to draw your attention in the first place to the letters of Paul to the early church. I think most of you are familiar with Paul, but for those who aren't, he was an apostle and was born a Roman citizen in circa 5 AD. And although of Jewish ethnicity, he was from the Mediterranean town of Tarsus, which is now in southern Turkey. And prior to his conversion, went by the name Saul. He was raised in the city of Jerusalem and was a member of the Sanhedrin, Sanhedrin being the group that were responsible for creating the trumped-up charges which led to Jesus' crucifixion. So despite a request by his colleagues not to slay the Christians, Saul became an ardent persecutor of the fledgling Christian movement, and he was indeed present at the stoning of the Apostle Stephen, which is recorded in the New Testament book of Acts. So soon after this, Paul had a vision of Jesus on the road to Damascus 2 years after the crucifixion, during which he was temporarily blinded, which led to his conversion. Well, 3 years after his conversion, Paul went to Jerusalem and spent time with the disciples, Peter and I believe it was James, where he received what is now known as the Creed. A creed is a statement of belief and would have existed before the Gospels were written down. The creed being that which Paul wrote in his letter to the church in Corinth: Jesus died, was buried, rose on the third day, and appeared to his disciples. So let's have a look at that timeline. Let's just remember we're talking about whether this is a myth or not, or if it's stuff of legend like Robin Hood. Well, if we look at the first thing we have here, obviously the birth of Jesus in AD naught, strangely enough, although historians would say that possibly he was born in 4 BC. But let's just assume for this that he's born in naught AD. AD 30, Jesus starts his ministry. Now, AD 33, we had the crucifixion. In AD 33 plus 2, Paul was converted on the road to Damascus. In AD 33 plus 2 plus another 3 years, Paul writes in Galatians, actually, chapter 1, verse 18, that he went up to Jerusalem and spent 15 days with Peter and James 3 years after his conversion, where in Corinthians 15, verses 3 to 8, he makes reference to receiving the creed. So as we can see, the latest date that the creed existed, as written by Paul, was AD 38. So if we have a look at that, AD 38 is 5 years after the crucifixion. So there's 5 years . So are we talking about a distortion of events? In fact, funnily enough, most scholars have put the creed as existing as early as 3 years after the crucifixion, because, of course, it would have already existed in AD 38. So we could probably say in AD 35, 36 would be the latest that the creed came into being. So are we therefore talking about a distortion of events after only 3 years following the crucifixion? So Paul already knew about the resurrection before the Gospels were even written. So are they stories or not? I think this kind of points the finger to it not being a story. Now, this is a guy called William Lane Craig, which leads me on to my next thing I wanted to talk about tonight, which is nuggets of evidence which we can extract by looking at the New Testament texts themselves. William Lane Craig is one of the greatest known Christian apologists today, and most atheist philosophers fear debating him. I do say that because I'm a big fan of his. In fact, funnily enough, Jez and myself went to see him about 2 years ago in Oxford at the Sheldonian Theatre to give what turned out to be a lecture on Richard Dawkins' book, The God Delusion. We'd hoped it was going to be a debate with Richard Dawkins, but Richard Dawkins refused to turn up on the grounds that he didn't rate him as a philosopher, but I would question that. That's another story altogether. But one thing about William Lane Craig is that he's come up with four historical facts, which I wanted to look at tonight, because I don't want you to think this is my own work. This is William Lane Craig's work, so I'm going to mention him. So in his published work, William Lane Craig has come up with four historical facts which must be explained when attempting to argue the case for the resurrection. And these are Jesus' burial, the discovery of the empty tomb, oh, it works, the post-mortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' belief in the resurrection. These are three important facts that need to be answered if we are to take the resurrection seriously. So let's look at the first one, the burial by Joseph of Arimathea. Multiply attested to in independent sources, the four Gospels all record the burial. And they're all independent sources written in different places, which we need to note. Mark was written in 65 AD, the author Peter. Although it says Mark, it was very likely to be Peter, because Peter was the disciple illiterate, and it's very likely he had a scribe to wrote the Gospels down for him, the Gospel of Mark down for him. That was in 65 AD, and that was in Rome. Don't want that bit yet. Luke, 66 AD, who was an associate of Paul, and probably a historian, wrote the book of Luke in Greece. So we had Mark written in Rome, Luke written in Greece, and Matthew in 66 AD. He was also a disciple, and he is believed to have written the Gospel of Matthew in Syria. So we have three books written in very close timescale, but in very different parts of the Roman Empire. Rome, Greece, Syria. I haven't got a map, but they were quite a long way away. So you have a very, very similar story told by three different sources. all talking about the same thing, but from different places. So obviously the original, they've obviously experienced the same thing, but at a much earlier date. And John, of course, the fourth gospel, which records it, was actually written in the late 80s. The author John, the disciple, which was written in Ephesus. Interestingly, John was probably the, history seems to record that John was the only apostle disciple who lived to old age. The others were martyred for their faith. So the burial of Joseph of Arimathea, multiply attested to in independent sources, the fourth gospel and the book of Acts, mid-60s AD, Luke. It reads as follows. When they had carried out all that was written about him, they took him down from the cross and laid him in a tomb. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, Paul the Apostle, circa 53 to 57 AD, he wrote, "For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures." Now here's an interesting one. We're talking about the burial of Joseph of by Joseph of Arimathea. And Joseph of Arimathea is unlikely to be a Christian invention. He was actually a member of the Sanhedrin, the court that had Jesus executed on trumped-up charges. And there certainly was an amount of hostility within the early church towards the Sanhedrin. So why would, therefore, a made-up account make him responsible for taking care of the body and giving him an honourable burial? Surely any legendary or made-up account would credit the disciples or similar persons with giving Jesus a dignified burial. Therefore, most modern historians view the burial of Jesus as a historical fact. See, we're trying to, so we're looking here to sort of look at the difference between fact and fiction. And if we're looking in the text, it kind of draws a very good, a very interesting picture, doesn't it? That these people really believe what they saw. Let's look at the second one, the second bit of evidence, is the empty tomb, of course. You can't preach a resurrection if you've still got a body. Consider that it would be impossible for the Christians to preach the Christian message in the face of an occupied tomb. I mean, you think about it. Peter and his disciples preaching with fearless confidence within the walls of Jerusalem that Jesus was raised from the dead, in the knowledge that probably a few hundred yards away lay his corpse in the tomb, which was incidentally known by many, and in particular the Sanhedrin, in light of his being buried by a member of the Sanhedrin, the very opponents of Jesus. So either the members of the council were surely would have exposed it by pointing them to the tomb, or in extremity would have exhumed the body of Jesus and paraded it for all to see. The tomb must therefore have been empty by the time the disciples started to proclaim the resurrection. The first witnesses, women, it says, were inadmissible. I've got to be careful what I say here. A woman's witness is inadmissible. Well, of course, whilst this would certainly seem unremarkable in the 21st century, in the first century, women were not considered a reliable source of testimony. So in the same way as it would be unlikely that they would have said that Joseph of Arimathea would have been responsible for burying Jesus, being that he was the enemy of Jesus, allegedly. In the same way, we could say it's kind of strange that a woman would be considered to be the discoverer of the tomb, in as much as they were not considered a reliable source of testimony. According to the Jewish historian Josephus, the testimony of a woman should not be permitted in a court of law. And consider early rabbinic sayings which say things like, "Blessed is he whose children are male, but woe to him whose children are female." Just as well I've got four sons, isn't it? So women were considered second-class citizens. Therefore, any legendary or forged account would have probably made male disciples the discoverers of the tomb. You see the picture here. All the things I'm saying are creating a picture of a historical account and not a story. Okay, the Jews knew that the body had gone. So the earliest Jewish opponents of the resurrection presupposed the empty tomb. By presuppose, I'm saying that they knew and admitted that the tomb was empty. The Jewish leaders said that the disciples stole away the body. So what does this say? It says that the tomb was empty. This in itself was an attempt to explain the fact that the body was missing. Read the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 28. When the chief priests had met with the elders and devised a plan, they gave the soldiers a large sum of money, telling them, "You are to say, his disciples came during the night and stole him away while we were asleep. If this report gets to the governor, we will satisfy him and keep you out of trouble." So the soldiers took the money and did as they were instructed. And this story has been widely circulated among the Jews to this very day. You see, I should think the early Christians who witnessed the resurrection of Jesus were quite narked that it was being suggested that the body of Jesus had been stolen. And the interesting thing is, I'm not sure when it was discovered, but it wasn't too long ago an ancient tablet was discovered called the Nazareth Stone, which dates back to circa AD 41, which would have been around about the time between the Emperor Caligula and Claudius. Not sure which one it was. The reason I'm referring to the Emperor is because this was actually a decree by the Emperor that anybody caught raiding a tomb would be executed. And whilst people would look at that and say, well, surely that's evidence that the body was stolen, if it was referring to that, all it tells me is that they knew that the tomb was empty, because it's natural that they would assume that the body was stolen if they didn't believe the resurrection story. So the third item, post-mortem appearances. On different occasions and under different circumstances, different individuals and groups of people experienced appearances of Jesus alive. Okay? Multiple witnesses over a period of 40 days. They're all independently attested to again in the Gospels. Paul's list of eyewitnesses to Jesus' resurrection appearances guaranteed that such appearances occurred. In 1 Corinthians 15 we can read, "He appeared to more than 500 of the brothers at the same time, most of whom are still living." It's strange, isn't it, that he's actually quite happy to say that and write it down, that, you know, it almost sounds like he's saying to them, "Don't take my word for it, but go and ask them for yourselves." It's quite a bold thing to say, isn't it? And of course, we have mass hallucination of the same event is impossible. Most historical scholars would accept that these appearances were genuinely believed to have been seen by individuals and multiple groups of people. If these were hallucinations, a large number of people would have all been hallucinating the same thing at the same time. Now, interestingly enough, and unknown to my son, who's here tonight, I'm not going to mention his name because he's looking a bit embarrassed already. He actually said to me this morning, "Dad, can you touch a hallucination?" And I said, "That's interesting." I said, "Can you touch a hallucination?" Well, the interesting thing was that when Jesus rose again, he walked up to his disciples. And one in particular refused to believe that he was alive unless he could see and touch him. And he offered to let Thomas, I believe, touch the wounds to see that he was alive. So, was it a hallucination? I don't think so. That's certainly what I say. But doesn't it seem absurd that 500 people all witnessed the same supposed hallucination? I can imagine it's a bit dodgy considering two people might witness the same hallucination, but when you consider 500 people, does that really stack up? Moving on. Okay, so the origin of the disciples' belief. The original disciples suddenly and sincerely came to believe that Jesus was risen from the dead, despite their having every predisposition to the contrary. And we have to... Why should they believe that he had risen? What we have to remember is that their leader was dead. And it should be noted that at the time there was no Jewish expectation of a Messiah who, instead of triumphing over Israel's enemies, would be humiliatingly executed as a criminal. The Messiah was, in their mind, supposed to come and restore the throne of David and rid Israel of the occupying Romans. It can't be stressed strongly enough that disciples at first, immediately after the crucifixion, would have assumed Jesus to be a fraud and cursed by God. Referred to as hanging in the Old Testament, a crucified person was cursed by God. Deuteronomy chapter 21 verse 23 makes this very clear, and it says, anyone who is hung on a pole is under God's curse. So the disciples would have been very troubled by this, because they would have seen their leader executed, and they were thinking to themselves, well, where do we go from here? Certainly, Jewish belief in the afterlife was not considered to be... resurrection was not part of Jewish belief. Jewish beliefs about the afterlife precluded anyone's rising from the dead to glory and immortality before the general resurrection of the dead at the end of the world. So what changed the disciples? For 3 days after the crucifixion, the disciples were scared and fearful, but suddenly became confident and fearless. It's kind of strange, isn't it? Well, Peter writes in 2 Peter 1:16, forget that. We did not follow cleverly invented stories when we told you about the power and coming of our Lord Jesus Christ, but we were witnesses of his majesty. So the perpetuation of the disciples' beliefs, this is one other item we need to possibly think about. Consider a case in a court of law. Assume that Peter is giving his testimony. What would be his motive? So what would he stand to gain? We have to consider that the apostles had no earthly reward to gain, especially if they were making this story up. And they certainly had every earthly comfort to lose. When we consider, history tells us that all the disciples, bar one, died as martyrs. And what was there to lose? They spent the rest of their lives proclaiming the good news of Jesus' resurrection. They had no pension plan or posh villa on the shores of Galilee. In fact, most of them were very likely executed in tortuous ways. Can it be that having seen a man crucified only to stay dead, that they would risk their lives for this lie? Consider James, the brother of Jesus. He was actually opposed to his brother's ministry during his lifetime and became an ardent follower after the crucifixion. So what brought about this transformation? His martyrdom is recorded in Josephus, the first century Jewish historian. And Josephus writes, so he assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others, or some of his companions. And when he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. Well, looking at, we've just looked at the evidence from within the scriptures. So this kind of reference to Josephus kind of leads nicely on to historical references. So let's have a look at a few historical references from outside of the Bible themselves. This is Tacitus, the Roman historian. He lived between 55 and 120 AD. And he wrote the following. Christus, the founder of the Christian name, was put to death by Pontius Pilate, procurator of Judea in the reign of Tiberius. But the pernicious superstition, repressed for a time, broke out again, not only through Judea, where the mischief originated, but through the city of Rome also. Now, interestingly enough, just that short sentence confirms quite a few things. It confirms that Jesus did exist. He was the founder of Christianity. He was put to death by Pilate. And that Christianity originated in Judea with Jesus. And that Christianity later spread to Rome through the apostles and the evangelists. So this was a guy that lived, was actually born in the same century as Jesus, and was recording events as a historian. He had no ulterior motive but to record history as a historian. And he refers to James. Moving swiftly on. Okay, we have Lucian of Samosata, who's obviously got a good supply of Harmony hairspray, judging by the state of his hair. I'm just a bit jealous, you see. He was a second century Greek satirist and physician who scornfully described Christianity. His writings confirmed that Jesus was executed and was the founder of Christianity. I did actually have to look up the meaning of the word satirist. I often hear it mentioned, particularly in the media. Apparently, it's a little bit like, you can imagine, he'd probably like a first century sort of Mock the Week presenter. So he'd be sat in the forum, wherever it was he was sat, taking the mickey out of events that were going on in the day. And he writes as follows. The Christians, you know, worship a man to this day, the distinguished personage who introduced their novel rites and was crucified on that account. It was impressed on them by their original lawgiver that they are all brothers from the moment they are converted and deny the gods of Greece and worship the crucified sage and live after his laws. Well, if that's first century satire, I don't think I want to sit through an episode of that. But the quote does confirm that Jesus did exist, that Jesus was the founder of Christianity, that Jesus was worshipped by his followers, and that Jesus suffered death by crucifixion. Then we have Pliny the Younger, who lived between 63 and 113 AD, again, very close to the time of Jesus. He was actually a Roman governor, so again, he had no ulterior motive. He lived in ancient Minor and tortured Christians to death, nice chap, unless they exalt the Roman gods and curse the name of Christ. He wrote to the Emperor Trajan with concerns that too many Christians were being killed for refusing to deny their faith. And he writes as follows. I asked them directly if they were Christians. Those who persisted, I ordered away. Those who denied they were or ever had been Christians worshipped both your image and the images of God and cursed Christ. They used to gather on a stated day before dawn and sing to Christ as if he were a god. That's interesting. All the more I believed it necessary to find out what was the truth from two maid servants, which were called deaconesses, by means of torture. Nothing more did I find than a disgusting, fanatical superstition. Therefore, I stopped the examination and hastened to consult you on account of the number of people endangered, for many of all ages, all classes, and both sexes are already being brought into danger. So he seemed a bit concerned at the rapid spread of this, what he calls this disgusting, fanatical superstition. I'm quite interested in the fact that he uses the word disgusting, because can anybody here sort of see anything disgusting about Christianity? But what I'm thinking is perhaps he kind of misunderstood certain aspects of it. And of course, I remember this morning we had communion, and communion, when we say we're drinking the blood of Jesus and eating his body, I mean, that's just, it doesn't literally mean that, of course. We're just remembering Jesus. But of course, I suppose Pliny the Younger may have misinterpreted that and seen it as something closer to cannibalism. I don't know. Now, here's a very interesting one. This is a guy called Thallus. There's no picture of him because not very much is known about him. He actually, in 52 AD, which was less than 20 years after the crucifixion, in fact, before any of the Gospels were written down, he made critical reference to the midday darkness that occurred during the crucifixion, which is very interesting. Only fragments of his writings survive, but a later historian from the 3rd century, Julian Africanus, picked up on Thallus' observations of the midday darkness and wrote, "On the whole world there pressed a most fearful darkness, and the rocks were rent by an earthquake. And many places in Judea and other districts were thrown down. This darkness," Thallus, in the 3rd book of his history, calls, "as appears to me without reason, an eclipse of the sun." The 2nd century historian Phlegon of Tralles also mentions the darkness, and like the previous one, Thallus tries to dismiss it as a solar eclipse. He also states that the event occurred during the time of Tiberius Caesar. Oh, forget that. I keep jumping ahead of myself. See, we have a biblical reference to it. If we actually look in the book of Luke, chapter 23, verses 44 to 45, it reads as follows. "It was now about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon, for the sun stopped shining." So this guy, Thallus, was actually making a reference to the midday darkness and trying to dismiss it as a solar eclipse, which was disputed by later historians. But what I should point out to you is that a solar eclipse cannot occur during a full moon. If there's any astronomers out there, you don't need me to tell you that, but effectively if there was a solar eclipse, the moon would move in front of the sun, and as it's a full moon, it would mean that the moon's around the other side of the Earth, so it wouldn't be going in front of the sun. Because the Passover, which is what was being celebrated when Jesus was crucified, always takes place when there is a full moon. So it's impossible for there to have been a solar eclipse, although something happened which made the sky go dark around about the midday. So in conclusion, I want us to remember the evidence I gave you following the assertion that the texts are faithful recordings of the events, and these are what we discussed: the Jesus' burial account, the discovery of the empty tomb, the post-mortem appearances, and the origin of the disciples' belief in the resurrection. So these alone, I believe, provide a compelling case for the resurrection of Jesus. But strangely enough, you know, everything we've heard about this evening might mean very little to some people. If Jesus were to walk in this room now as the risen Lord, it would certainly be something, wouldn't it? He just walked through that door and came down here. Well, something like that certainly did happen to the disciples, as we read in the Gospel of Matthew. Then the 11 disciples went to Galilee, to the mountains, where Jesus had told them to go. When they saw him, they worshipped him. But look at this, it says, but some doubted. I mean, it's incredible to think that, isn't it? But what does it tell us? It tells us certainly that no amount of physical evidence will convince an unwilling mind. But if you prepare to search for God with an open heart, he promises that you will find him. I did say earlier that the main evidence that I have is God, is Jesus living in my heart. And that's the main evidence, I'm afraid, the only evidence I can give you. I can give you, that's the only proof from my own understanding that I can give you. The rest is only evidence, I'm afraid. So Matthew 7:7 reads, ask and it will be given to you, seek and you will find, knock and the door will be opened to you. Well, the door which wants to be opened is the Lord Jesus, who came to this earth to take the punishment for our wrongdoings, thus opening the doorway to God. So Jesus is that doorway. Knock and the door will be opened. If you're sincerely searching for God, knock and the door will be opened. So I hope tonight you've been challenged by that which I firmly believe, that approximately 33 AD, a man named Jesus of Nazareth was crucified, and on the third day, a miracle occurred when God raised him from the dead. I think that's it. Thanks for listening. And you might want to just talk amongst yourselves for about 2 minutes. I'll sit down, and then you might want to come up with some questions amongst yourselves, and chat amongst yourselves for a minute, and speak to you in 2 minutes. So I've put myself in the firing line now. If you've got any questions, I've made sure that the door there is off the latch so I can do a runner if there's any questions I can't answer. So has anybody got any questions? Alistair's got the roving mic, and here's the first one.
Thank you. Can you say something about the seemed to die but didn't really die question? Because a lot of people think that.
He seemed to die but didn't really die.
Yes, he's the swooning rather than that he died.
Well, I think the crucifixion was a very tortuous affair, wasn't it? I mean, he not only had nails put through his hands, he had them put through his ankles or feet or whatever, however you want to say it. And to make sure he was dead, they put a spear in his side. Also, when he was being tortured, they used what's called a flagrum, which is the most horrendous torture device imaginable. It's literally a piece of wood with loads and loads of bits of rope or leather hanging off the end of it, with bits of sharp stone, bits of metal, bits of tooth, bits of anything that could just rip away at the skin, and he was tortured with that. Then taken to die, he could barely carry the cross, he was so weak. We hear of the cross having to be carried for him, and he died very quickly. So I'm just trying to imagine a picture of A, Jesus managing to get out the tomb, which was incidentally guarded, and then appearing to his disciples, and he'd be an absolute mess, wouldn't he? So I think the apparent death theory, I think it's certainly been debunked by a lot of theologians and historians as being very unlikely, if not virtually impossible. And the other thing I want to say is that if he had come back to life again, but only on a human level and not as the Son of God who we believe him to be, then he would have stayed around and done stuff. We got no record of him doing anything after his resurrection apart from appearing for a while and then ascending to heaven. So that's what I would say in response to that. Pierre. I'm glad there's young people here tonight.
What's the difference between evidence and proof?
Well, as I said earlier, evidence, I said it's like the smoking gun. You saw, if you go into a court, if you go into a court and someone's been accused of murder, all right, you might have a gun that's got his fingerprints on. And it was known that he was around the vicinity of where the crime took place at the same time, but it can't be proven that he was there. That's evidence. Proof is if you actually see it for yourself. So he would have proved himself to the disciples by coming back to life and appearing to them. But all we have now, because it's happened in the past and we physically can't see it, we now just have evidence. Okay? Does that answer it, Pierre? Pierrick?
The question is fairly simple. It's I missed something that you said when you were talking about Josephus, and I just wanted to clarify it. Sorry.
Which particular bit?
Pardon?
You have to remind me.
That's what I don't want.
Josephus was a historian.
Right.
First century historian, and he recorded the... just hold on a minute, let me get my notes. The good thing about having notes... amongst yourselves. Yeah, well, we hear about him yes, I didn't mention him, did I, in the actual when I was showing pictures of historians. I actually just mentioned he actually recorded, he was a Jewish historian of the first century, and he recorded the martyrdom of James, who was the brother of Jesus, which actually I think we read about in the Bible. Was it a different James? I'm not sure. And he said as follows, so he assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called the Christ, whose name was James, and some others, or some of his companions, and when he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. So that's historical evidence of martyrdom of one of the apostles.
Okay.
Okay, which we don't see a lot of by historians. Okay?
Thank you.
Steve, I have a question if I may. You've presented a case that there's a much stronger body of evidence for the biblical account than there is, say, for other accounts of ancient civilizations. Why do you think it is then that the people seem to be a lot more willing to accept the accounts of ancient civilizations, for which there is a weaker body of evidence, than they are to accept the biblical accounts, for which there is a stronger body of evidence?
I think it depends on your worldview. I just think a worldview is like how we're brought up, how the world around us, we perceive it. And I think some people are predisposed to believing in the possibility of the supernatural, and some people are predisposed to just believing in the scientific, etc. And I just sometimes think we just need to put our worldviews to one side. I mean, I've done that tonight, because I believe in Jesus. He lives in my heart. But tonight I've actually just spoken about physical evidence for the resurrection. So I would just encourage people that are of the disposition where they don't want to listen to evidence, just to put their worldview to one side and just look at it purely objectively. So I just think people are predisposed to not believing. Because, I mean, people would possibly say, well, look, we know that Tacitus wrote this, and we know it happened because we've got all the archaeological evidence. Well, what we've also got to remember is that what happened in the time of Jesus was in a little remote corner of the Roman Empire, which they weren't particularly interested in. There wasn't much going on in Judea and Israel at the time. So there wouldn't have been very much evidence at all from a physical point of view and from an archaeological point of view, although funnily enough, I think, was it in the Victorian times that this pool of Bethesda, was that physically discovered? One of the New Testament accounts refers to... Where's the pool of Bethesda? Anyway, it's... Anyway, it was discovered. It was something that was always considered to be a myth, just made up in the Bible, and it was discovered in Victorian times. So there are a degree of physical evidences that we can see, but they are very, very few and far between. So that's kind of a roundabout answer, but I hope it roughly answers it. Lynn, have you got one for Harold?
No, all this evidence is great, but you do need the Holy Spirit.
You certainly do, yeah.
To live your life with Christ within you, don't you?
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing that I said at the very end, that it's about Jesus living in you. And no amount of evidence will prove it. It's only what goes on in here. It's wanting to know Jesus. And it says it all throughout the Bible. I knock at the door, you know, open the door and I'll come in and sup with you. It's very clear. So unless you actually are looking for God or want to look for God, it's going to be very hard to find him. I know people that have actually discovered God by going through a process of elimination. I mean, you don't mind me mentioning yourself, do you, Alistair? Alistair, when he was a much younger man, went through all the different world religions and sifted through them and looked at the pros and cons, yeah? And then came to the logical conclusion that Christianity must be true. Because I think it stands up not only from a spiritual perspective, but from a physical and practical perspective as well. You got one, Jess?
I think that one.
Okay, right, it's fine.
Well, hopefully you found that to be an interesting walkthrough of the evidence. Just a couple of things I wanted to say in conclusion. If we were to ask the question, is it likely that Jesus rose from the dead? There is a chap called Bart Ehrman from the United States, and he claims he was a Christian, now he isn't a Christian. And he tackles the resurrection from a sceptical point of view, because he says, from a statistical point of view, if you look at all the people that have ever died, nobody's ever risen from the dead. So the statistical probability of Jesus rising from the dead is essentially zero. And William Lane Craig, who Steve mentioned earlier, counters this and says, look, if we said that Jesus just naturally rose from the dead, you know, that it was just one of these really odd things that happened, he said, or rather, if we just said all we knew was an empty tomb, then your first conclusion certainly wouldn't be that he'd risen from the dead. But the Bible isn't describing a natural resurrection. It's describing a supernatural resurrection. The Bible says it is God that raised him from the dead. So it would be unwise to look at the resurrection from a likelihood point of view, because we're talking about a supernatural event. The second thing is it rational to believe? Now, again, towards the end of last year, I did a talk on whether or not belief in God is rational. And you may find some of these events difficult to believe, but that's not the same as them being irrational. That actually there's a real logical view of these things, and much of the evidence that Steve's presented, there is some in the non-Christian history books, but much of the evidence, the real bulk of it, the real descriptions are found recorded in the Gospels. And so I would just encourage you to read the Gospels for yourself and see whether or not you think they have the sound of fiction to them or the sound of history. Do these letters, documents, read like the works of J.K. Rowling, you know, a rousing fantasy fiction, or do they read like the record of people who actually saw these things and really believed them to be true? If Christ's mission had ended with him dying on the cross and being laid in a tomb, he probably would have only made it into the ranks of the very many noble martyrs who have died over the years. He would certainly have been somebody to be admired for his passionate devotion to the cause. But it's unlikely that he would have endured for 2,000 years if he had not, in fact, risen from the dead. And really, the last thing I want to leave you with is where Steve began with C.S. Lewis, the lunatic, liar, or Lord. And again, just to lay that challenge before you, to again read the Gospels, read the story of Jesus. Mark's Gospel is a great place to start. It's only 16 chapters, it's very, very short. And to read that and say, this person that's presented, does he come across as somebody well-meaning but extremely deluded? Does he read like somebody who was a confidence man, who persuaded people around him that he was something he really wasn't? Or does he bear the hallmarks of somebody who really was Lord of heaven and earth? And as Steve's made very clear this evening, that's a question only you as an individual can decide. And Hot Topics is not about persuading people to become Christians. Hot Topics is really about answering some of the questions that people have to some of these big issues. So hopefully you can go away and look at that evidence and reflect on it. I'm sure Steve would be very happy to send you his notes or some of the PowerPoint slides if you wanted to have those. And the talk should be available on our website in the next few days if you wanted to go back over and listen to it. So I would encourage you just to reflect on the evidence for the resurrection. I want to thank you very much again for coming out this evening, and hope you can stay for some more tea and coffee. And just to remind you, the 13th of April, we have Sharon Dirks speaking to us on God, evil, and personal suffering. So if you're able to join us on the 13th of April at 6:45 again, it would be great to see you. Thank you, and God bless.